afternoon and welcome to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Yeah. Can you believe it's July? Well, I mean, today's not July, but it's July. For all intents and purposes, the heat will tell you that. haven't been outside lately, that heat and humidity, pretty bad. And it's going to build, too. So, but it's South Carolina. Summertime, you just expect this. But it is the Saturday before Fourth of July, not Thanksgiving. And I'm glad you, if you're listening to me, I appreciate you tuning in today to the show. Going to get right into it because there's, of course, with Fourth of July, I always tell you where all the fireworks are and all that. So I got that for the calendar of events this year again. But I've got Ross Self is going to join us, and we're going to talk about largemouth bass. And we're going to talk about, we had Monday night in Anderson, we had a striped bass meeting about the fishery on Lake Hartwell, and it was just really interesting. I think I took like 3.5 pages of notes, and I got to write an article about it, so I got to get that together. But we're going to talk a lot about bass because there's no fish that generates more revenue to our state than a largemouth bass, so we're going to talk about that, stripers. And if we have any time left over, I got some other stuff. But let's jump in. Because there's a lot going on with 4th of July coming up next week. And there's a lot of things that you can go do for the 4th of July. So, as always, the calendar is brought to you by Visit Anderson Green Pond Landing and Event Center. And we're going to start off with landing and events. we had, back a few weeks ago or so, we talked about boating safety. And for the 4th of July, the Department of Natural Resources is going to have those courtesy boat inspections set up all across the state. The River Forks boat ramp on Lake Hartwell, the main lake at main ramp at Lake Bowen, Greenwood State Park, Lake Murray Dam, Dorn, Billy Dreer, Rimley Point, Wapu Cut, Carol A. Campbell Landing on Sampit River. And those are all, let's see, some of those are on the 4th. They're spread all over. Goodness gracious. Have some on July 3rd, July 4th, July the 5th, and then July the 6th. Starting with Wapu Cut is on the 6th. Rim is on the 6th. Going back, the Lake Murray Dam is on the 4th. Greenwood State Park is on the 4th. Lake Bowen is on the 3rd. Billy Drew Island is on the 4th. Dorn is on the 4th. South Cove at Lake Huey is on the 5th. The Lake Murray Dam again on the 6th, Villager Island on the 6th, 12 Mile Park on the 6th, Battery Creek Landing on the 7th, William Dennis Landing at the Tail Race Canal on the 7th, Garris Landing on the 7th, and Conway Marina Landing at Waccamaw River. You can find a list of all these at the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources website. And again, these are courtesy inspections. They're going to look give you a quick but thorough inspection of your boat to make sure you have the required safety equipment, proper boat and motor registration before you launch. Those, you know, if they find something that's wrong, they're going to give you a complimentary ticket, which, you know, won't cost you anything. It'll just tell you, hey, here's what you need to get fixed before they launch your boat. So, anyway, hope you have a good time. There was a good article out there by Boat US about surviving the 4th on the water. I just didn't have time to read it today, so we won't get to that. Before anything happens on the 4th, and, you know, I bet somewhere in here in this whole stack of stuff is something that's happening on the 3rd. I know it is. Rock Hill. That's right. The Old Town Rock Hill is having a 4th of July show on the 3rd. And you would have thought I'd have put these in order, but I just threw them all together. Ah, here it is. Red, White, and... Well, they're saying the 4th. No, it's the 3rd. There you go. Red, White, and Boom July 4th celebration. Old Town Rock Hill is going to happen on the 3rd. Starting at 5:30. Enjoy food, drinks, live music, and tons of family fun. Admission is free, but budget money for rides and food. You have live music, mechanical rides, kids zone, and all. That's Old Town Rock Hill on the 3rd. And then before everything gets going on the 4th, if you're going to be at the beach, and I usually have these guys on. I didn't this year, just ran out of time. Salute from the Shore, the 10th annual flyover of the South Carolina coast on July the 4th is going to happen Thursday, the 4th. And they're having a, in addition to some of the airplanes, they always have the vintage planes and warbirds and stuff like that. They're adding this year a flight of F-18s from Marine Corps Air Station Beaufort and a C-17 from Charleston Air Force Base, so which would be pretty cool. And if you don't haven't heard about the Salute from the Shore, go to Salute from the Shore and find out all about it. But they want you to get out on the beach, red, white, and blue, so all the guys flying the coast can see you. And it's a really cool idea, and it's, like I said, it's the 10th year of Salute from the Shore. So if you're going to be on the beaches of South Carolina on the 4th of July, this is something you need to do. Go red, white, and blue, and go big. And then here's just the list. You ready for this? Harbor Fest, 4th of July fireworks show, Shelter Cove Harbor Marina and Hilton Head Island. Starts at 5 o'clock to 8:30 p.m. with fireworks after that. Yeah, July the 4th. So there you go. Harbor Town, Hilton Head Island. If you're not interested in going to the beach or anything, the 60th Annual Hillbilly Day, Thursday, July the 4th, 2019. I hate when I do this. Because when I print these out, a lot of times it doesn't print where it is. Anyway, bluegrass music, arts and crafts, clogging, hot dogs, quilt raffle, and a lot more at Hillbilly Days in Walhalla is where you can find that. And I'm sorry. If you look at Mountain Rest Community Club, bingo, there it is, July the 4th, and it's pretty much an all-day event. So look that up, Hillbilly Days. Calpins, well, that's not till the 6th. Here we go, Spartanburg, Red, White, and Boom on the 4th. 6 p.m. presentation of colors. They're going to have a community band, Declaration of Independence Red, band called Steel Toe Stiletto, and then 9:35 fireworks finale. Clemson Fest. This is July the 3rd. So there you go, another July 3rd. 5 to 10 p.m. It's the 26th annual Clemson Fest at a new location, 1569 18 Mile Road in Central. Gates open at 5 o'clock, and festival will continue until 10 o'clock. Fireworks at 9:30. Again, more live music and Carolina shag bands. So if you like shagging, go down to Clemson. Let's see, which one is this one? Oh, Red, White, and Blue in Greenville, South Carolina is the premier 4th of July celebration, showcasing one of the state's largest fireworks displays. This free event features live music, fun-filled activities, kids' zones, and a variety of popular food and beverages downtown. Takes place downtown Greenville from Broad Street to Augusta. Calpin's National Battlefield is going to hold theirs Freedom of Celebration event on July the 6th with guided battlefield walks, weapons, children's activity, living history, and fun for the whole family. Da-da-da. Who else do I have in here? Get rid of that stack. Oh, that's the Wells Fargo Greenville 4th one. Had that printed out twice. 4th of July over Lake Wiley, presented by Camp Thunderbird, July the 4th. And Camp Thunderbird is right there near Lake Wiley at the Buster Boyd Bridge. You can watch it by land or by sea. 4th of July on Lake Murray, Drury Island State Park and Spence Island. Yeah, they shoot fireworks off of both sides of the lake. This one's going to be on the 4th of July at dusk, which is approximately 9:15. So by land or by water. In either park, you can go Drury Island State Park or Lake Murray Dam State Park. You can see it from land. Patriots Point down in Charleston is having theirs. And then probably the best one of all is the Lexington County Peach Festival. You combine peaches with 4th of July. Yeah, I'm in for that one. It does cost $5 to park, but you can eat all the peaches you want. Don't tell them I said that. Pawleys Island is having a 4th of July parade starting July 4th at 10 a.m. along with stuff. Oh, goodness, where's this one? Oh, well. Maybe I'll get to some of these after the show. But anyway, hang on. We're going to talk to Ross Self about bass and stripers when we come back with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. As advertised, we have been joined by Mr. Ross Self, who is Chief Fisheries for South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. Is that right, Ross?
That's correct.
That is correct. I knew I'd get it right one of these days.
But that's perfect.
That's right. Fifth time's a charm for me.
There you go.
Ross, we had a, we're going to talk about this a little bit later on in this interview, but we had a meeting Monday night down in Anderson about the Lake Murray striper fishermen. I would say you had
Lake
a pretty
Hartwell.
Good
Lake Hartwell, striper.
Not Murray. See, I got it wrong already. But I had a pretty good crowd. What do you think?
Yeah, I was real pleased with the turnout. You know, it turned out to be a little bit of a stormy night, but we had between 55 and 60 folks in there. I thought it was a real good turnout for a weeknight like that. I was real gratified to see the number of folks come out to kind of talk about the issues up there.
And it seemed like there was a good many people from Georgia down there too.
Yeah, there were. You know, it's that interjurisdictional fishery concept up there. You know, the fact we got the reciprocal license and what goes on there affects both folks in Georgia and South Carolina. It was good to see folks from Georgia joining in there. And I appreciate the folks from Georgia DNR taking time to come over and be a part of that meeting, too.
And you had the lone guy from the Corps of Engineers who tried to
keep
his head
poor
down.
Old Jamie. Yeah, we've known Jamie a long time. He's a good guy.
He tried to stay out of it, though.
Best he could. He'd been there before.
That's right. He'd been there before. The poor guy's got one thing on his one thing they're responsible for is generating power, and yet he's got to please everybody in the world, the boater,
that's
the
true.
Fisherman.
That's true.
Yeah, he's got a tough job. So
it's true.
But we're gonna touch on that a little bit later on. But really, you and I talked about this last fall, I think. I don't know how far we go back with this idea about largemouth bass. Our bass in general, and you know, it's been said many times, and the statistics and documentation there, nothing generates more revenue in fishing than a bass.
That's true. That's you know, one of the most pursued, one of the most popular sport fish we have in the Southeast, for that matter, you know, not just South Carolina. But.
And we have to continue to draw the tournaments that we have come here. It seems like every year, every couple of years, we have an absolutely incredible fishery.
Yeah, we're very fortunate. We got a lot of water for such a small state, and we've got a lot of reservoirs that are real conducive to pretty decent bass fishing, black bass fishing in general. And luckily, we've got a lot of local partners on these impoundments that have embraced the idea of using those recreational fishing opportunities to draw people into their communities and work real hard to help support and provide a positive place for tournaments to come and have their events. So it's a combination of the work our folks do to manage the fishery and that local interest in bringing anglers out to enjoy the resource and take advantage of the opportunities in those local communities. It's a good model.
Yeah, it's a great model, and it continues. I mean, I think we're going to see more and more of those type tournaments, right? And when you get a tournament that comes in like that, the after effect on tourism has got to be big, because there's a lot of people that come in here and watch those tournaments, and they turn right around, and a few months later they come here and fish.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and a lot of the, you know, particularly the big things, you know, that FLW and the BASS folks do, you know, those that not only do they generate excitement while they're here and, you know, through social media and that kind of stuff, but, you know, they're replaying those events on their broadcast outlets over, you know, I just saw the elite event up at Hartwell replay just a week or so ago. So, you know, you get months and months of exposure for your fishery resources and your recreational opportunities through having those folks come in and carry out hold their events in our area. So it's a good thing for the state.
It is. It absolutely is. You know, talking about largemouth or black bass, there's more than just the largemouth there in South Carolina that we can take advantage of fishing for. I mean, the largemouth bass gets the coverage, like you said, the radio, the TV coverage and all that. But we've actually got more than a few types of bass here in South Carolina.
Yeah, we've got, you know, in South Carolina right now, we have four of the recognized black bass species. We got the one everybody's most familiar with, largemouth bass, is native to the state.
Okay.
Then we've got a little endemic small river bass called traditionally called the red eye bass.
Right.
There's some debate going on now about what if it's a different species or not, but it's part of this red eye bass complex. But it's a smaller bass, smaller black bass, kind of found in in riverine habitat, kind of in the upstate, you know, kind of northwest corner of the state. That's a, you know, it's a real pretty little fish, a good little stream fish to target. And then we've got, the spotted bass that was introduced into South Carolina through questionable means. It wasn't something that the agency did. Yeah. And, you know, and a lot of folks get excited about spotted bass when they show up, but they don't have the growth potential and they don't produce the same quality fishery that a largemouth does. Over time, and there's some issues associated with having spotted bass established in your waters. They compete with some of the native fish, particularly with the little red eye.
Okay.
And then years ago we did some studies and made some decisions in a couple of places to stock and introduce smallmouth bass. So yes. We got some smallmouth bass up in Kiwi and over here in the Broad River in the Midlands. So we've got a smallmouth fishery, a largemouth fishery, a spotted bass fishery, and this little red eye, or what some folks these days call Bartram's. But a little red eye bass fishery too.
Now, isn't there a study going on with the red eye or Bartram's right now out of Clemson?
There is, and like I mentioned, that little red eye or Bartram's bass is real vulnerable to the impacts of expansion of spotted bass.
Okay,
the spotted bass will hybridize with the little red eye. and they hybridize to the point that they essentially over time can eliminate the presence of the red eye bass genes in that system. And what comes out the backside of what geneticists call a hybrid swarm,
okay,
as this hybridization goes on, what comes out the backside of that after a little while is a little bass population that's predominantly spotted bass. So it almost eliminates the red eye from areas where they can expand. And we've got some work going on with some of our folks and folks at Clemson trying to identify where we still have pure red eye, pure Bartram's.
Okay.
And trying to look at this hybridization thing and trying to develop some management protocols and things we can do to try to push back against that elimination of red eye by the hybridization with spots.
Tell you what, you hang on to one of those little things about 8 or 9 inches long with a 4-weight, and he'll think you got a brick on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they got a lot of spirit.
They do. And then you mentioned the smallmouth fishery. You know, Broad River's, you know, I've done the Broad down up around Gaffney. Pretty good population. But, boy, I tell you, that down there around Columbia, that broadmouth, smallmouth fishery on the Broad down there is probably rivaling some of those, like you look at in Virginia and all that.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular in some areas. And you know, I think one of the things that's really allowed that to develop and establish like it is because it's so hard to get to them.
Yeah.
You know, the public access on the Broad River is very limited. There's not a lot. It's not a lot of easy ways for folks to get out there and fish for them. So those that find ways and can get out there have a real special opportunity to experience a really, really, really top-notch smallmouth fishery out there.
Yeah, because you're not going to put a bass boat in and run down the Broad River to fish.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You got to use some little more covert methods.
That's exactly right. Well, what about, okay, so we didn't mention stripers and hybrids. Do you not, they're not considered what were in the bass fisheries in South Carolina?
No, they're what's referred to in the literature as a temperate bass. So they're a different species, different genus, different family of fish. You know, the largemouth are more closely aligned with brim and those types of fish. But, you know, the black bass are in the genus Micropterus.
Okay.
And the stripers and white bass and high, you know, those are in a genus called Moroni.
Okay.
So they're very different animals, different habitat requirements, different lifestyles. So that term black bass refers to those bass species that are in that genus Micropterus, which is in South Carolina, largemouth, smallmouth, spots, and red eye.
One thing you and I have talked about, and it's a popular topic amongst bass fishermen, and we got about 3 minutes here to cover this.
Mm-hmm.
You got what we have native black bass here in South Carolina, or largemouth bass here. What? And you hear all the people, oh, we ought to be importing Florida strange largemouth and all. What is the difference, if any, between those two?
Well, you know, traditionally, historically, they were thought to be the same species and just have subspecies differences between the two. You know, the Florida bass tends to be in a more southerly species, occurs in the more southerly parts of the country. The northern largemouth was naturally in the more northern parts of the country. But in about 2002, I think it was, the Florida bass was elevated to, it was given species status by the taxonomist, so it's considered a separate species now. But South Carolina, what's unique in South Carolina and parts of Georgia is we're in what's called the integrated zone, where we naturally had northerns and Floridas coming together. So what we have in South Carolina, as you move from the southern part of the state through the upstate, is varying percentages of each of those bass in there. We have a high percentage of Florida genetic traits in our bass already. I mean, on the order of 85-90% in some areas. The Savannah chain of lakes. I was just looking at some. We did this evaluation of the genetic makeup of our bass probably 15 or 20 years ago. And saw that in that gradation as we moved up from about 90% down around Marion and Moultrie up to probably 65-70% as we moved further north. Georgia just repeated that, or did a similar study using more modern techniques in Georgia within the last 5 or 6 years, and has very similar results. They looked at some of the lakes along the Savannah, and we're looking at probably 80-90% Florida traits in those black bass or largemouth bass populations in the Savannah chain, all the way up through Harville. So, you know, stocking Floridas wouldn't really give us anything. What we have occurred naturally is what most places are trying to get to when they stock Floridas.
All right. So,
and I guess that's the take home message is we've got already what folks are trying to get.
Which makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's, interesting,
because that's something that's not widely understood or widely known by a fisherman, because they see all the press about Florida fish, Florida bass. But yeah, we're lucky to already have that here.
Well, that's a big question that I've heard a lot. So, Ross, hang on through the break. We're gonna take a 3-minute break here at the bottom of the hour. Come back. We're gonna talk more about bass and stripers and all the rest. So, hang on for more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Had a few chuckles with Ross there over the break. But, Ross, what you said, you don't get to say it enough about the Florida strain bass in South Carolina. So I'm going to give you another opportunity to tell people what we ended up the segment with, just to reinforce it and make sure everybody understands. But what we've got here in South Carolina is what a lot of states look for when they say Florida strain bass fishing.
That is true, because you know a lot of places that are stocking Floridas are stocking them on predominantly northern populations, trying to infuse some of those Florida traits into their bass populations, and with us and the folks in Georgia essentially being in what is known in the scientific community as the integrated zone, where the two species naturally come together. You know, we have a bass population that probably has the best of both worlds. It has traits from both northerns and Floridas. And for it's kind of shocking if you look at the numbers, because our bass in South Carolina already range from probably 60% Florida genetic traits to around 90% genetic Florida genetic traits. And that was just reconfirmed by a more recent study that Georgia had done in conjunction with Auburn University, looking at using a little different genetic technique than we used, you know, several years ago. And so, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we've got what folks are trying to get generally.
Let me ask you this, and I know this is way off the wall. If you brought what you consider 100% strain Florida bass to South Carolina, would you essentially just be degrading their lineage down to what we already got because they didn't breed?
Yeah, they would, and you know what we got is what has evolved to best suit the environment and the conditions that those fish are living in. So it's unreasonable to think that we could push something to 100% Florida traits. It would always be something in the middle, you know, with northern and Florida traits meeting together, because this is that natural zone where some of those traits do better than others and the species come together and they kind of intermingle. Okay. So this is a, you know, this, like I said, folks in South Carolina got it, have it pretty good relative to largemouth bass, because we have, like I mentioned, what a lot of folks are trying to get to through spending a lot of money moving a bunch of fish around.
Gotcha. All right, there yet you've had an opportunity to say that twice now.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Large bass, and this is real informational today because we, like I said, you and I have talked about this for probably 6-8 months doing a show like this. A lot of people bass fish. A lot of people don't know what they're doing. I think the more information people have on what they're catching helps them understand how to conserve and be good stewards of resource. So. Take just a couple minutes. Talk about the life cycle of a largemouth bass. You know, from the spawn to the habitat they like. You know, age, resilience. How long a largemouth bass lives. You know, just kind of run through that stuff for us.
Okay. Well, you know, all these numbers that we'll talk about are you know, these are numbers that are coming out of literature and out of the books. And you know, you got to remember that the fish don't read the books. So this is all kind of an average or general idea, but you know, largemouth bass spawn in the spring, generally between March and July, when the temperature is around 57 degrees, they begin their spawn.
Okay,
and you know, bass can reproduce at about a year and a half, or about a year old. You know, as they age, there'll be higher and higher percentage of the females that are sexual mature as you move through them, you know, up to twos and threes. But you know, the males will construct a nest, the females lay the eggs, the males fertilize the eggs, and then they guard the nest.
Okay.
They're, you know, according to the literature, you know, it's been documented that largemouth bass can live up to over 20 years old.
Wow.
Now, you know, they're being pursued.
Sure.
a lot. So it's a 20-year-old fish is a rare event.
Okay.
But they do have, you know, they have the potential, you know, to live for a long time, you know, to live for many years. The growth in length slows down, but the,
sure.
but their bellies keep growing kind of like me and you, Roger. they'll continue to put on some pounds and put on some ounces as the years go by. But,
sure.
But you know, and by comparison, say spotted bass, you know, according to the literature, the life expectancy of a spotted bass is more like 7 or 8 years. So they don't have that longevity, which probably contributes to the fact that they don't exhibit that growth potential of a largemouth, because they're just not in the system they just don't exist as long in the wild. You know, all those smallmouth, the largemouth, the red-eyed spots, they all their spawning is all triggered about the same time.
Okay.
Spots may spawn just a smidgen earlier, so that may give them a little bit of a jump on other populations that they're cohabitating with, which probably helps contribute to this hybridization thing where they're ready to reproduce before a little bit ahead of everything else. So when everything else starts, they're already in position and can be taking advantage of opportunities to crossbreed with some other species. You know, of all of them, the red eye probably spawns the latest. It's not spawned until it's about 62, 63 degrees generally. And, you know, it tends to be more of a riverine species. Or you find it where it was found in reservoirs. We don't really have many red eye in reservoirs anymore because they've been displaced by spots.
Okay.
But they would spawn, you know, along riprap or up in the rocks, kind of rocky habitat. But, you know, they tend to be more of a riverine or small rivers, big creek, small river type species.
Which is odd, because that water is normally colder.
Yeah, that just means they wait till, you know, they're probably not spawning until May, June. Okay. You know, so they're probably a couple of months behind what you think of with a largemouth.
Hmm. Interesting stuff. Which brings us to this. You know, you guys are charged, Department of Natural Resources is charged with managing our resources, which includes bass, all the black bass and all.
Yeah.
And we hear about when you have big studies, you know, when you have a study going on this and all. What are some of the stuff that you guys do on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis that involves the bass fisheries here in South Carolina?
Well, you know, every year, and it doesn't get a lot of attention, but every year our staff is out sampling largemouth bass in our reservoir. We don't have enough folks to sample every reservoir every year, okay. But we'll generally go in and sample a reservoir for two or three years in a row, then rotate to another location. But we're probably sampling something on the order of 24, 25 impoundments every year.
Oh, wow.
Looking in the spring.
Okay.
We use electrophishing. You know, it's a non-lethal technique. It allows us to go out and target particular species, particular size classes and things. But we use electrophishing, go out and collect the bass that we turn up with electrophishing. It kind of stuns them for a few minutes.
Sure.
And,
yep.
And, you know, they'll recover in two or three minutes and swim away. But we'll bring those on board the boat. You know, measure lengths and weights generally. Occasionally, we'll have to sacrifice some fish to take out a little bony structure out of their head called an otolith,
okay.
That we use to kind of determine the age of the fish. And from all that, we can make inferences. We look at, you know, with the length and the weight information, we can look at, you know, the length frequency distribution. Do we have a good distribution of sizes in the population? With the weight information and length, we can get an estimate of a thing called relative weight or relative condition, which kind of gives us an indicator of how plump or how healthy the fish is. You know, fish that has plenty of food and good habitat, those relative weights, relative conditions are, with relative weight, it's based on a scale of 100 relative condition factors based on one. But, you know, we look for weights in that 90 to 100% for relative weight and around, you know, 0.85 to 1 for condition. But, you know, that's an indication that the fish have enough to eat. They're not outpacing their prey. They're in good condition. And then we can look at the age. When we age those fish periodically, we can look at the distribution of age classes in the population, be sure we have a healthy distribution. I mean, a lot of different age classes showing up. And with that age and that growth information, we can calculate how fast the fish are growing from one year to the next. And from that, you can kind of calculate some mortality and the rate of loss that's occurring in the system. And then, you know, that goes on every year. And that doesn't get a lot, you know, that's not one of the things that gets a lot of attention, because that's kind of what we call routine survey and inventory.
Okay.
So that, you know, that's our primary tool for looking at largemouth. And beyond that, we can, you know, if we see things that raise some concerns, we can go to another step or two where we do some tagging, and we can do some exploitation estimates, and we can kind of tease apart that part of the mortality that's natural and that part of the mortality that may be associated with angler activities or fishing losses.
Okay.
You know, another thing that we try to do, it's an expensive undertaking, and we can't do it everywhere as often as we'd like, but that's what a lot of folks may be familiar with, is a creel survey, where we have staff out that are talking to fishermen on the water, generally on the lake or in an access area, to talk to them about how long they've been fishing, what they're catching.
Okay.
Get some of their input on how they perceive the lake to be functioning, how they perceive the fishing to be, whether it's good, bad, mediocre.
Depends on which day you catch them on.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so, you know, that's a real important thing it kind of gives us a measure of angler success and angler satisfaction for that matter.
Well, I tell you what, if we take another break, we'll make this last break happen.
Okay.
If you got a few minutes, we'll come back on the other side. We'll talk just a little bit about striper fishing meeting that we
have. I'll be here.
All right. Hang on, Ross. We'll be right back with you. Everybody else, hang on. We'll be back on the other side with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. I'm still chuckling. The older the bass get, they quit growing in length, but they keep adding the girth. And, well, that is
something we can relate to.
I knew I liked them for some reason or another. Now I know I have physical character traits that emulate a bass. That's going to be a good one. I'm going to use that one a lot down the road. I can tell you that right now. Thank you, Ross. I'll try to give you props when I can.
I appreciate it.
Oh, well, you were good enough to give us a few more minutes. the striped bass fishery at Lake Hartwell, die off 2013, die off 2018. I think you guys, we pretty much know why. Talk just a minute about the research study that's going on down there. And then y'all talked Monday night. You brought up there's an oxygen layer those stripers in late summer go to, and how it condenses and why it condenses and what's affecting some of this stuff. So take just a minute, tell us about the survey, and let's talk about what that layer down in Lake Hartwell.
Okay. Well, we recognize that the striped bass fishery at Hartwell is not meeting folks' expectations right now. Like you mentioned, we had these two die-offs that occurred, at the end of the summer, just this past year, and then by then with 13 or something.
Right.
But that, that's all related to these natural. Well, in response to that, we've tagged some stripers out there in conjunction with Georgia, in collaboration with Georgia, and we're monitoring movements. That summertime habitat can be a problem for stripers. As stripers get bigger and older, they get more sensitive to temperature and oxygen extremes, high temperatures, low oxygen.
Okay.
So, and traditionally, fish hold in front of the dam in a deeper layer of cool, oxygenated water. Well, we've tagged some fish with transmitters, and we're trying to look and see if there are other refuge areas that stripers are using in that system in the summertime, or if everything's still kind of stacking up in the forebay or down the lower part of the lake.
Okay.
So that telemetry study that's going on will give us a better sense of how the fish are moving and where they're holding different times of the year. And then we've tagged some other fish doing a little what's called the exploitation study I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think.
Yes.
To kind of get an estimate of the mortality that's occurring and to determine what portion of that mortality can be associated with fish and what portion of that is related to natural mortality or fish just, habitat conditions that just make the fish sick and they don't survive.
Sure.
So we want to be able to tease those apart. Because if you don't, if most of your mortality is occurring from natural causes, there's not a lot regulations can do to help that.
No.
Generally.
Yeah.
And we're fortunate here that we're dealing with a put, grow, and take fishery. This is not an area where we're managing for reproduction with stripers.
Okay.
So all those fish are stocked from hatchery. So we don't have to be concerned about trying to accumulate reproducing size fish, but those are the fish that folks want to catch. We want to try to have as many big fish in there as we can. But the habitat issue there is occurs all across the southeast in these reservoirs that have been built over the decades, and it seems to be worse in those years where we have high spring rains.
Okay.
and higher temperatures. As those rains in the spring come in, the water coming in from the watershed, it's a little bit warmer, and it's bringing a lot of organic material, stuff off the watershed, leaf litter, nutrients, other things are washing in there.
Okay.
And all that stuff that's coming into the upper lake has a demand for oxygen as it breaks down. These density layers form, warmer water is less dense than cooler water.
Sure.
So you wind up with the cool water being deep and the warm water being higher in the system because it's not as dense. And the density can become so density difference can become so great that those two layers won't mix, so they stratify or stay separated from one another. And so generally what we see is those largemouth will go down to those cool layers of water that are denser and don't mix with those surface layers. And because everything that dies falls through the water column, so those deeper layers of water tend to lose oxygen faster. And in years where there's high flows coming in, you have more generation, more hydropower operation, so it pulls off that cooler oxygenated water and pulls downstream, that cooler water, but with more oxygen demand, and so it has less available oxygen to support the fish.
Gotcha.
And as the summer goes on with a lot of generation, you see that layer of water that can support stripers become smaller and smaller as the summer goes on. In a good year or a normal year, that habitat, it will persist all the way into the fall when the surface water's cool and the lake begins to circulate and mix together again. So you don't have a problem. The fish are have more available habitat to use. But in some years that available habitat gets pulled off faster, the surface layers stay hot longer, and you wind up with conditions in there where the oxygen's so low that the fish become stressed and can die. They tend to lock in on the temperature, and they won't venture out to feed. So as the summer goes on, they lose condition. They become less plump, begin to kind of get starved a little bit for, you know, lack of food. So generally going into the fall, you see a lot of stripers that are kind of skinny.
Okay.
But as they move on through the winter and the spring, you know, they're migrating around the lake. They're feeding again. They put that weight back on. But, you know, it's that loss of habitat that occurs on what has traditionally been an odd weather year, where you had a lot of spring inflows, which results in high generation rates and pulling off that available habitat, that fish need, that stripers need to oversummer, get through that hot period in August and September.
Yeah, and y'all made a good point, you know, that stripers just don't like, you know, low oxygenated water and warm water, whereas bass and crappie, they love that high water where they can get in all the brush around and spawn and all. So what's good for bass and crappie, not necessarily good for stripers and herring and all.
That's true. You know, bass are much more tolerant of warmer water, and that all that nutrient load coming in is producing plankton and microscopic plants and animals that their offspring are eating when they're produced. But all that extra production like that is contributing to the depletion or the decline of oxygen in the deeper layers of the lake as it decomposes and falls through the water column. And I think, you know, they talked about you have some oxygen loss at the surface from the biological activities going on. You have a lot of oxygen loss even to the sediment in a reservoir.
Okay.
And so you wind up with stripers being caught as that habitat begins to pinch down on them, and they the area that they can occupy comfortably becomes more and more limited. In a bad year, it's limited to the point that you have stressors that are inflicted on the population, and you begin to lose some fish. The natural occurrence is that, like I mentioned earlier, the bigger fish are more sensitive to temperature and oxygen, so it's generally the bigger fish in the population that fall prey to this condition first when those years occur that the conditions set up like this. So when one of these events occurs, it's the bigger, more desirable fish in the population, more recreationally desirable fish in the population that are affected most. Mm. And in turn affects the anglers the most.
Sure, that's exactly right. I think you had a good group of people that I think we're interested in what you're saying and really, you know, came out of the meeting going, there's probably not much we can do when you're getting rains. You got no control over it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was impressed with how they seemed to latch on to that those concepts we were talking about and began. I think they understood things pretty well as they were walking out that night. So. But we're continuing to look at that and look at possibilities and see if there is any kind of regulatory thing that could happen that might improve things or something that can be done that will help accelerate the recovery.
Okay. Very good. Well, Ross, I appreciate you taking so much time to be here and do this. It's been fun.
That little stratification water density thing, habitat pinch, that we could probably spend 45 minutes on that.
Yeah.
That can get deep in a hurry.
Yeah, it can be. And that's why I didn't want to get that deep today. Maybe when some more of these studies start, you're getting some more data from the studies, we'll do that. We'll spend a good bit of time on that. But I appreciate you taking the time doing this with me. And we'll get to spend some more time here at ICAST shortly.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing you in Orlando here in a couple of weeks, Roger. A
couple of weeks, that's right. Well, thank you, Ross. Take care of yourself, and I'll see you soon.
All right, thanks, buddy.
Yes, sir. I hope you were taking notes because there was a lot of information there, but it's a lot of good stuff. And Ross covered it so well. I enjoy talking to him. But let's see. About 3 minutes here. Yeah, let's see. Well, I got a couple more things for the calendar events that I didn't get to first time. July the 6th, that is next Saturday, Family Fishing Clinic Columbia, courtesy of the Department of Natural Resources. It's going to be at 1154 Old Garners Ferry Road in Columbia. Clinic will teach skills on how to tie knots, how to rig a rod and reel, casting, and the best part is everybody will get to try their hand at fishing. Kids from ages 4 to adults are welcome, so come out and play, enjoy the outdoors, and make this a family-friendly day. You can find more information about this under the Aquatic Ed tab on the Department of Natural Resources website. And this one came across my desk. I just thought it was great. July the 13th, Bird Dog Social. Absolutely. Saturday, July 13th at 7 o'clock, Poor Tap Room in Greenville, South Carolina at 7 Falls Park Drive. Come out and enjoy some good company and a great time on July 13th. It says bring your dogs. Now, I don't know if you want to bring your dog into the poor tap room or not, but that is up to you. I know my setters, they would not have done well inside. But it says you can bring them or leave them at home. This will kick off our first event to build our group and meet some new friends. We hope you'll take time to come out and have a good time. So if you're into bird dogs, and I know there's a bunch of people out there, take advantage of it. And I guess we'll end this one up with some good news. We all know development. We lose a lot to development, you know, habitat and wildlife and everything else. The Save Shem Creek Corporation has some breaking news, and this came out a week or so ago. We are thrilled to announce that the purchase of Shem Creek's Wando Dock by the town of Mount Pleasant has been finalized. This purchase by the public of one of the last two commercial docks on the creek gives the fleet, which is the Shem Creek Fishing Fleet, a permanent home on Shem Creek in the face of rising real estate values and development pressures, and will preserve our town's working waterfront heritage far into the future. It says, thanks so much to the following people, owners Lisa and Chuck Sigman, who could have sold to developers for a higher price, but wanted the property to remain in use by the fleet. Brett Elrod, who stepped up into the breach when the owners were ready to sell and sought a way to save the property for the fleet. And to the town of Mount Pleasant's elected leaders, particularly Councilman Tom O'Rourke and Mayor Will Haney, who championed this effort from the beginning. So the shrimping fleet in Mount Pleasant on Shem Creek will have a home for however many shrimp boats happen to be there. Anyway, appreciate you tuning in today. Next weekend is the 4th of July show, and I'm going to have a best of from past shows. In the meantime, make time to get out there, take the back roads when you can, and don't forget that camera. Back with more Woods and Water South Carolina next Saturday.